Whatever I talk about, actually, the whole field of literature for children is, if it's any good, it should be something that's worth reading for any adult who has any imagination. And I guess I'm rather not in doubt. I wish I were in doubt, but I really feel badly that our imaginations generally are about as poverty-stricken as some areas of the world are poverty-stricken physically. I think it was about 8 or 9 years ago, down in Guernavaca, down in on the bridge between South America and Central America, Ivan Illich had a big sort of a colloquium or session down there with a group of people, particularly from the Roman Catholic Church, since this was a Roman Catholic center for training missionaries to South America. And it was on poverty. And Daniel Berrigan gave a lecture on the poverty of the imagination. And I remember reading it, and I was so impressed because it seemed to me that that was the affluent society was remarkably poor in that particular part of our lives. The sad thing about it is that the fact that we are poverty-stricken in the imagination does not hit us because we have so many substitutes for it. I mean, you can look at a television program, you can read a magazine, you can look at a movie, you can even listen to a conversation that somebody else is supplying all the imagination, and you don't have any. And as a result, you're just, you really are one of the most poor of the peoples of the world. Because another remarkable thing is that the people who are in primitive societies have a great deal of imagination. Their lives are full of legends and myths, and I remember Lawrence Vanderpost, who's an excellent writer on South Africa, wrote a book called The Lost World of the Kalahari. It's about a tribe of people in South Africa. They're really pygmy in size, and they are a fascinating group to study because they are so close to their origins. They're still living in their same primitive society that they had apparently thousands of years ago. And he said that when he went in to see them, and he had learned enough of the language of the different tribes because he was born in South Africa. And he said that what was common to all these tribes, and even the tribes in this really lost tribe of the Kalahari, was a sense that they had a kind of another world that was part of their world. When they were going to go into battle, for example, they'd always have a preparatory period, and when they talked about it, they'd say, we have a dream dreaming us. It was as if, and this was not being, you know, carried off in some mystical, far away sort of thing, but it was as if their minds were filled with a sense of their, you know, of their nation, their tribe, what they were about to do, and also a feeling that they were getting divine power in this way too. Now, I'm not advocating this. I shouldn't say anything, but I don't laugh at football teams that pray because I don't laugh at anybody. I don't think any of us has any right to laugh at people who pray ever, because the Lord knows and we know that none of us prays enough. But I always think that that sometimes we think that if we just get together and and pray, that the Lord is certainly going to give the football team a winning victory. Well, I went to St. Olaf when we lost all the games, and there were a lot of praying Christians there, and they were praying, and they used to pray, and I don't know how, but I don't know whether the football team prayed, but I know that the coach was a Christian, and he prayed very specifically for his team and for his, and for the people that were, that even the people that were going against them. But the interesting thing about Abe was that he prayed for the individual players, that they would play a good and honest game. And he didn't pray for them to win. He prayed that they would be men. And sometimes he even kept people out of the team that he felt it would be the worst thing in the world for them to be in that team, although they probably would have been an asset to it. Well, you know.
When we talk about the, I want to emphasize this imagination that's been the term poverty stricken, and I agree, and several things, as you said, that kind of went wrong. Do you think that it's any better or any worse in our country today with the use of the imagination than it was 25, 30 years ago? 40 years ago.
Well, I think most of you could answer that question. Maybe think about it. What are some of the elements that have come into our society within the last 20 years, 25 years?
Television
has certainly come in, and it can be a real feeder for the imagination.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say now. Look, some of us grew up, and I had to put myself in the position where children and young people were to be seen and not heard. And if you had some fanciful thing and you told it, if it was a fantasy,
it was a lie, really chastised
because you were telling a lie, and it could be the most real thing rather than making a useful situation of it. And I don't know, but in youth today, and having worked in schools and so on, I believe that children express themselves more and tell these things and are more open. And then it depends on the listener and what somebody else does as to whether this grows within that individual or not.
I think
maybe we're better in some senses. Now, I assure you that if no one ever makes any use of all this, we're certainly entertained to the nth degree if we want to be. And then whether you make anything out of that is another whole ball of wax, too. You can or cannot. But it depends on with whom you are and whether you're encouraged to. Nothing breeds success like a little success. And if you're listened to, you feel, gee, I'm worthwhile, I've got something to say, and then you go on. But if no one listens,
I think that's true, that there were a lot of people who grew up in the surroundings where this was really dampened. But even if you didn't talk about it, I think that you were driven to read books that were filled with it, because at least I did. I didn't have parents. My parents didn't read to me, and they weren't. My father was very busy, and so was my mother, and I was the youngest, and it seemed to me that, you know, I didn't have anybody that talked to me about anything. Mm-hmm. But I did go to the library. Mm-hmm. And the library was the biggest thing in my life. And I got a library card. That was really my entrance into adult world. I felt like, you know, now I've got it, and I could take out all the fairy tales I wanted to. And I think from the point of view of, for instance, children's books, the way they're put out and the way they're presented, they're so much more beautiful now than what we had, you know. I still remember the shock I had when I took out the Andrew Lang fairy tales, and one was the lilac fairy tale, lavender fairy tale book, one was the red one, one was the green one, and I thought the pages would be green or something. It was just a title, and I suppose the original volume, in order to differentiate them, was a different color. But there weren't even pictures in that book. Mm-hmm. But because of the fact that, you know, you didn't have a television program to look at, and certainly we weren't allowed to go to movies, you know. So as a result, you know, your whole life had to be nurtured on the inside of your head. Now, I am I'm not, I couldn't be married to Carol and be opposed to movies and television, because he's an addict. But he, I think, I don't mean that he sits and looks at just anything, but he is very concerned, and he was very concerned up here that there was no television, simply because he felt that we got much too cut off mm-hmm. from the life of society. It's all very ideal to think, oh, well, we live in the mountains and, you know, we don't have all those interruptions. But how are you going to really understand what the kind of life that's going on if you are not aware of some of the news? And and your prayer life gets extremely, you know, kind of routine. You no longer pray as Werner does for specific instances that he sees on the news regularly. He takes it as a Christian duty to keep track of it so that he can guide our noon prayer life in that particular way. So there's a lot to be said for it. And I'm not putting down television as such, because I think it has such tremendous, just untold possibilities. But what I feel strongly about is that when anything that we take as a substitute for what should be going on in our own heads, no matter how wonderful it is, it's not going to be good. I don't care how beautiful a painting of Jesus Christ is. If you don't know him yourself, you know, let it hang on the wall, you know, and turn your back on it and don't have it there if that's all you've got. And that's where I think a substitute for anything, no matter how good it is a substitute. Mm-hmm. And what you think of and imagine yourself is always, something that happens to you rather than something that's somebody else has thought for you. Now, I think television can be a great stimulator for that, just so it doesn't take the place of the kind of daydreaming and image making that should, well, I shouldn't say should, but that can go on in the lives of most of us. And you know, if you stop to think of, just think about little children, it's not hard to go from what we consider the real world to the let's pretend world. Mm-hmm. Not at all difficult. And yet they know they're pretending, but they look at you with really, really askance if you start applying day by day rules to their pretend life, because they've got a whole system of their own in which they're living, you know, at that, in that level. And I wonder if, not that I think we should move in and out of a secondary world that easily, we'd have a hard time keeping track of ourselves, probably other people would too, but on the other hand, it's too bad when we lose it so totally as we do. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that can be nurtured and nourished if we make use of some of the children's literature that is available, and not feel that what we're looking at is sort of, well, I'll do it, you know, if you really, really insist, or I want to be a good grandmother, or I want to be a good friend to this little child, I really like to get acquainted with her, so I'll read to him or her, and you know, sort of a good works attitude. It doesn't really do all that much for you, and usually it's because the kind of books that you're using are not all that much fun, and there are so many good ones that it's too bad to be starving ourselves in that direction too. I'm not trying to sell books from the bookstore, because we are not having any trouble with our book sales. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't want you to feel like you have to go over there and buy books, because you may not want to haul them home. That mm-hmm. anything that you have to carry is another weight. But I think it's something to remember when you do get home, that you don't just let that drop out of your consciousness, but that you think about some of these books, and if you haven't read them and haven't seen them, that you actually make use of them. They're available in libraries, and you can check them out there first to see whether you want to spend any money on them. Most of them are available in paperback, but even paperback is expensive nowadays.
Mary, may I just interject something here that came up when you were talking about fantasy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think of, we always, I always read to the children at night. We'd read a Bible, we'd read a fairy tale. One would follow the other. And so, and I use my old fairy tale. But I often make up a story.
That's
and,
very important.
And Stephen particularly liked Mickey Rooney at that time, although, you know, he just thought Mickey Rooney was just wonderful. And so I would tell stories about Mickey Rooney coming in a plane on the landing on the Catholic playground next door, and I would involve them with him. Do you know that last summer when I visited them, he's a professor now at Northwestern University, he has two little children. And so we came up for prayer time, and then after prayer time, he says, Mother, will you tell the children a story? He says, you know that one about Mickey Rooney. And I thought, wow,
you're
hearing that last summer, he was 36 years old. Still remembers Mickey Rooney coming down to the Catholic playground, you know. So,
but that's really true, though. I think that we don't realize how much these experiences mean to children, and if you can make up a story, even if you can't make one up, if you know a story and you can tell it. Now, there are some times when they'll say, aren't you going to read to us? Well, why don't we read a story? Because then, of course, they can check you out, and, you know, usually if they've read it enough times, they know it better than you do, and you didn't read that sentence. Or you didn't read that. You skipped something. But I think if they get used to the idea that there is a possibility of somebody telling stories, and when they find out that there's another world also for you, that puts you in a really one-to-one relationship that's quite different from somebody who's simply depending on the printed page. Now, not all of us are that good at telling stories. Carol is great at telling stories, and so I leave it up to him.
But a good reader, though, too. A good
can do a lot.
I can turn around, show the picture, and read upside down. You know, I often look at the kindergarten people when they're going to visit, and the things they could do, and I just marvel at it. But I have a friend that does something real nice. She gets on the idea, and she has a little grandchild that lives quite some distance from her and doesn't get to see this little girl very often, and she's not in school yet. So she buys interesting books, and then when she's going to send it to little Julie, she records it on tape, and she reads it. And she'll say, now look at the picture, Julie, and you see this, and she talks to her and reads it, and then says, turn the page, Julie. And so Julie can have the little book, and Yvonne, the grandmother, is reading it. And they
that's a really good idea.
And she sends these periodically.
Gee, that gives me a good idea. I don't see mine very often.
Christmas or birthdays, but she just does this periodically.
And that doesn't have to be grandparents. I think a lot of times, so many children are really lonely for a grown up to pay some attention to them. And I think how much fun it would be to get a date from somebody that you knew someplace or that your parents knew that is, you know, a grown-up person. Okay, they sent me a tape and read me a story.
There's no lonely place either than in children's hostel.
That's right.
I used to get a group of them together and we'd read a story at bedtime. We'd never get all the way through, you know, but we'd say, well, we'll finish this tomorrow. Then, you know, tuck them in. But boy, that really makes a difference in crying for mom until you fall asleep.
But a tape wouldn't satisfy that situation.
No, I think you really need the closeness.
And it would have to be a nurse, I suppose, because you couldn't, I mean, a visitor couldn't come and do it.
I don't know. You know, there were so many times I wish there would have been somebody because it didn't get done because I couldn't do it because there was something that felt
right.
Had to be done.
That'd be a place for the volunteer. Volunteer mother.
Well, I think a lot of times there are things like that that could be. You know, we think about people go and read to the blind or to people who have difficulty in seeing, but we don't always think of the fact that people could go and read to children who really need it. Yes,
the candy stripers do this, and somehow.
Sometimes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you been to the Children's Hospital in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. all the right floors, mm-hmm. and they have a little library there every so mm-hmm. often. They have wonderful mm-hmm. books there, so they must have somebody that comes.
I'm sure
them.
They do.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Well, always. Maybe not. Those books just sit there.
Do they? Well, that's a tragedy. Well, I think that I'm just going to give you just a short, you know, collection of some of the books that I think are that I have found to be fun and not just acceptable but enthusiastically received by children and adults as well. And then when I get through, then we'll have it open for suggestions that you might have of books that you want to add to it or that you know about that you think would be fun to include. There are a number of different blocks of books, you might say, in terms of categories. Like there are books, for instance, from history and backgrounds, you know, that you sort of think, well, I should really get my children into this, or this child ought to know something about his heritage or her heritage. And you know very well, you don't want to do it in terms of a lesson plan or something like that. But what you want to do is give them something that's entertaining. The great thing that C.S. Lewis got across to me in one of his books was that the hardest thing that anybody does is write a good children's story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's why I think it behooves you to be very careful when you look at a book. You know, they are so expensive, children's books are, and if you don't take a good square look at that book and what kind of text there is in that book, you may be just sold down the river with a lot of sort of trashy writing or something that just has no meaning at all. And you'll say, well, the pictures are good. Well, that's good. If the pictures are good enough to warrant the book, fine. But don't buy it unless you know what the text is. And that's what so often is the case with like books when you want something that's really going to have a good effect on somebody, like a good background book for history or something like that. And then nobody's going to look at it, and even the parents are going to be bored and go to sleep reading it. So try to project your own imagination when you're going to buy a book for a child and see, would I really be interested in that book? Would I sit down and read that book? And face that quite squarely, then you decide whether you want to spend $4.95 on some of those things that look very very glib and very slick. But the text is just not worth it. I'm going to bring up some books today that are old classics, because most of the time, if you go to a children's library, you can get the children's librarian is extremely helpful, and she will tell you some of the really good books that are available to you right there in that library. But they're usually current. And I'm going to tell you some of the books that we used with our children. And Johan asked me once, he said, how did you bring us up? And I've been trying to figure out, how did you bring us up? I was going to write a paper on it, and he was out at Williams then. And he said, I just can't figure out. And I started thinking, I don't know how we brought them up. You know, I really can't say. We didn't follow any particular pattern or big plan or, you know, topsy-ish. But, you know, with six children, you think, well, they, almost all of them, well, I guess I'd say they all may have imaginations. And, but the only thing I can think of that we did do regularly, we did read out loud a lot. And when we were in the car, Carol would tell stories. Well, you know, sometimes I wish you wouldn't, because some of them were so frightening that there would be difficulty with nightmares the next night. But But generally speaking, the reading aloud or telling stories with the family has I think meant a great deal. And when I couldn't read or Carol couldn't read, which was quite often because Carol wasn't home very much, but as soon as one of the older children could read, that was great. And even after we had television, it still did not, that did not dim the excitement and the interest in reading. So we were able to get some of the books on history and backgrounds, like we read the myths and legends of the Greeks, and we read the Tanglewood Tales. Now, I don't know how many of you know what the Tanglewood Tales are. Anybody know what they are? Well, Nathaniel Hawthorne put together some marvelous stories of the old Greek myths, and he wrote them in a way that children can understand. And I remember when we were in Heidelberg, and well, maybe that was a help, of course, because anytime you go someplace where they don't understand the language, it's a great community builder for the family, but because they have nobody else to go to. But on the other hand, when we got home, the Tanglewood Tales remained popular with our family. We read the stories of the Greek gods and goddesses and the Roman gods and goddesses, and they really would get excited about, you know, why in the world do they do such dumb things? You know, what was the idea of that, you know? And they really, to them, it was a very real kind of involvement. I remember when we read the Norse myths, which included the Swedish and the Danish and Icelandic and Norwegian. And, I remember Johan, our oldest boy, he cried so at the death of, because he knew that this one brother was going to come back and kill his brother when he got back to Denmark. And he was one of the, you know, one of the old heroes of the Norse sagas. And Johan wept and wept and wept, and ran out in the kitchen, felt very embarrassed because he was crying. And you might say, well, now, should you read stories like that to children? You know, isn't that alarming to them? And isn't it destructive? Well, I don't know. I read them when I was little, and I really think that it helps to enlarge your it enlarges your imagination, but it also gives you an understanding, a real understanding of some experiences that you're going to be going through eventually anyway, but that you really sense them. You feel into them. And all of a sudden the printed words become living. They're not just they you don't get the idea that just because it's in a book, it's dead. The people are dead, the writers are dead, the book is old, and still it breathes. And that's, I think, extremely important for children to realize. You may think, well, of course, maybe your children hadn't had that much television. Well, they hadn't had as much as the children nowadays probably have, although I think a lot of parents who are concerned about their kids are being careful about the kinds and the times and the amounts of television exposure that children are getting. I know that when we started reading the Indian stories, and we went through we read Longfellow's Hiawatha, and I don't think anybody, I don't know if anybody reads that anymore. I suppose it's not considered it. I don't know.
My mother used to read it to us.
Yeah. Well, you know, that and it still is a beloved book in our family. You know, they probably because we have a cabin up on the north shore of Gitchigumi, but you know, it's still I think whatever part of the country you live in, I think the myths and legends of that place geographically, Indian and early pioneers and so on, is I think a vital thing to implant for children's memories and children's imaginations. I think, you think, for instance, of, when you think of stories from history, not just the history books sort of thing in terms of the leaders of the of our country or the kings and queens that were desperately bad or wonderfully good or what have you, but I think of the popularity of Little House on the Prairie, for instance, as a television program. Well, long before it was a television program, it was the most sought after book in most of the libraries. So it isn't, you know, this is definitely a situation where the book aroused the imagination of the public, and so that when somebody suddenly realized how popular that book was in that series, you know, they really lit on something very, very lush in terms of a good commercial venture, because certainly that must be making them a lot of money, because it's popular for adults too. And I know that was a book that those books were books that the children could read together. I mean, they'd read to each other and just go on and on and on and make up, you know, that they could live into that world and they could make up that world then and live in that world after they finished. Let's pretend we're in the Little House on the Prairie now. Let's pretend we're living out there in the plains of South Dakota, you know, and that's, you know, then it becomes very living and active and exciting. I know that some of you, I was going to mention too, in terms of the historical backgrounds of some of the myths and legends were the King Arthur tales. I don't know how many of you have read them. They were always a conundrum, because nobody could figure out, you know, what was he looking for in the woods all the time? What was this grail? Why was it there? You know, and of course it's a lot easier if you don't read books like that, because then you have to answer questions that you don't know the answers to and have to make up something, which of course, you know, if you're an honest person, you feel a little bit nervous about the fact that this is a pure fabrication. But then I always figured that nobody knew for sure anyway, because you know, after all, King Arthur and his knights are pretty good legendary material, and you can add something to it and maybe make it more interesting. When you think of some of the books that talk about another period, you think about the Little House on the Prairie, for example, in the United States. And I remember we used to read a lot of, there were Little Girls of Ticonderoga, the Little Girl of Boston. There were other, a whole series, and they were marvelous. The Bobbsey Twins were very popular, but I don't feel that they're necessarily, you know.
But they're
being reprinted.
And there was the Ruth Fielding series.
Oh yes, there were. But the thing about these little the girls of all these different cities in the East, it was all a history of the you know, of the Revolutionary War. And you got all these different things happening. You know, I think one reason I remember some things is because I read about it fictionally, and it seems to stick better for me. I don't have a very good memory on some things. The Louisa May Alcott series, for example. Now, I really do believe that Little Women and Little Men would be, I could, you know, recommend those simply because I think that although they are very much period pieces, and as someone said, only in that particular New England area at that particular time could those books be written, but then that's true of a lot of literature. It could never be written anywhere else or in any other circumstance. And it gives you a remarkable and very human approach to life in that Civil War period. And yet, it wasn't the Civil War that I remembered. It was Beth's death that I remembered. And it was Amy going to Europe and marrying this young Lawrence that poor Joe was so in love with. And, you know, all these things were part of it. And along with it, I realized as I got older that the Civil War was very much the big shadow that overarched the whole series. And I realized that the more I thought about it, I realized life goes on underneath all that tragedy. And in the midst of it all, life goes on and little things are enjoyed, big things occur in families, and they're all in the perspective of this one thing, and yet you're not conscious of the overwhelming pressure of that war situation. And I think it gives us a sense of, realize that we can deal with, and you're, the children who hear these stories, I think later unconsciously realize, you deal with things as they come. You just don't live with the feeling of, oh, I can't, the sky is falling. You know, because your whole life has been nurtured in that sense of being able to live in situations that are extremely difficult, and yet the humanness of life is very much to the fore.
Also, the diary of Anne Frank.
For the
adolescent.
Yes, for the adolescent. I was thinking more of children, and I, yeah. The thing about the Little Women is that you don't get a feeling of, it isn't quite as it isn't sharp in its portrayal as the Diary of Anne Frank is. Certainly, that is, you know, is a book that is obviously one that you know, people will read and should read and want to read, but it isn't something I don't think that you'd read to a little group of children, you know, at night. Particularly, mm-hmm. although it certainly is something that could be read, shared by teenagers, if you could just get people to read to each other, it'd be great. Then there are I feel the thing that I missed a great deal, and I think that is very present in today's children's literature. There's a lot of really good material out on science and the whole new world of exploration that has occurred, you know, within the last century, I would say more last 30 years. It's been so very, very evident for us that it can be put into children's literature. And also, I think we have a sense of wanting our children to know more about it, because this is the world they're going to be living in. Perhaps Peter and Pam know more about the some of the tiles that are good. I always get a little nervous because I don't know whether they're how sound they are, and whether they're just, you know, again being sold a bill of goods by the makeup of the book, and maybe what they're reading about isn't all that actual. But it's something that, again, I think you can ask you can talk to your children's librarian about it. I believe in asking people questions, not the person selling the books necessarily, but sometimes they can be trusted. It depends on who they are and where they are. But certainly you can find out in a library, because librarians are supposed to know at least something about the material, and children's librarians are usually pretty knowledgeable on what's good and what isn't.
The Holland White books are especially good, I think,
mm-hmm.
and they can take them by themselves.
Mm-hmm. I think things that they can read themselves are extremely important, too. Now, I don't know how many of you believe in reading stories from something, I mean, a condensation or a children's version of something, but I know that I remember the Old Testament very well because of a Bible story book. Mm-hmm. Now I know that I don't think that it should be substituted for Bible reading, but I think that there's a lot of the Old Testament that needs to be understood in terms of an ongoing history, an ongoing story that continually changes, that these are really exciting people. I don't know how really exciting this is to most children nowadays, because they think it's just something that's being foisted on them from the Sunday school or something, and as a result they don't get the real panorama of it. Oh, I remember so clearly one of the Bible story books I had, and every time I hear the psalm and the, about the horns and the trumpets and everything. And I think of that time when everybody had to fall down in front of the image of Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you know, they didn't fall down. And I used to read that over and again. I think how scared I'd be, and I wondered if I dare to do that. I mean, I read this all by myself. Nobody was reading it to me. That's where I think that if you can get your children interested in reading, if they don't have anybody to read to them, at least they can read to themselves. And there, you know, your imagination has to fill in a lot, because if nobody is explaining or helping you with it or anything, you're developing some muscles up there that are going to be serving you the rest of your life. The New Taizé Bible, for instance, is a good paraphrase in terms of children's reading. I think Edgar Meyer's is still good. I remember Hurlbutt's, and I also remember a lot of little ones that came out periodically. Sometimes I think we tend to get so many of them in one family that we don't read any of them, and that can very, very often happen. So I think if you kind of look over what you're going to, what you'd like to give somebody, and find out if they've got too many others, because sometimes if you get too many, as I say, it gets to be why bother? Let's have something new.
Mary, mm-hmm. I think drama can be used very effectively in the Bible stories. I found this both in the Sunday school and in the choir school, where we would use drama.
I think drama can be used in every single book that has some action in it.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely.
From God.
Yeah. And I think we ought to use more drama in the Sunday school than we do.
And they improvise their own. I mean, you tell
that's
a story,
the most important thing.
You feel it.
Yeah, let them improvise, because it makes it much more lively.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, yes. That's
then
the way they pretend.
Words that come out.
Yeah, right. That's right. Especially comes from the playground along with it. You wonder how that fit into the Old Testament, but it does. you were saying about the problem first, before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about art books. I think a lot of children are starved for in terms of the imagination, in terms of art, because of the fact that we don't ever look at anything basically most of the time, because it hasn't been part of our, you know, we just it's been part of our life. And so as a result, we don't think it's important for children. Now, these books, which we have down here in our bookstore, but are available in most bookstores, and they're very expensive. They're $5.
Yeah.
Well, yes, but I've been taught by Carol to always add 5 cents. I always, instead of reducing it, I have a sister who always says it's $4
yeah.
if it's $4.95. So I just go one better, and I always put it up one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
that's a wonderful bargain for that.
But by the time you have to pay the tax, you're going to have to pay it. Cookie Heworth was saying that she said she didn't think that the text was very good for small children. It's rather sophisticated, she thought, for most children to read. But actually, the good thing about it is that it's the sort of thing that an adult or an older child can read to a younger child, and both of them can share the experience of the book, and then because it's printed, you see, I mean, sort of, it has a fun text. Now that I love to look at colored letters and different shapes of letters. I don't know why they're so dull in the way we print. I just don't understand. I think the Lutherans ought to be the first to explode on printing in a different way, something fun. Because we make so much of the word, and the fact that we had, you know, we were publishing the Bible, and you know, this is where it started in Germany, at least with the press, with the Gutenberg press, and yet we seem to be satisfied with such.
Don't you think our banners are going to help that?
Well, I hope so, and like just so they don't substitute it for. But now you take this kind of thing. And if you go down to the bookstore, you can find them. They're down on the lower shelf when you go in, and they're worth looking at. Even if you don't have any children, it's like the Pieman. And if you don't have any of these little elves, then you're going to have to eat them all yourselves. That was, you know, when he was selling the pies. And that's the way I feel about these books. They're really great for people who don't see a lot of art. It really introduces you. It's exciting. And there are a lot of different artists that are included in it. And now these, I brought the Taizé Picture Bible over here because I thought if you're interested in looking at it. And the Arch books, which are put out by Concordia Press, and they're all some of the newer ones that have been coming out, but every publishing house is trying to make a lot of the biblical stories exciting. And now I'm so happy about these art books coming out, because I think they're going to really open the eyes of a lot of people to what's available. I haven't mentioned nursery rhymes. I don't know. Does anybody, do people read Mother Goose anymore?
Oh, yeah. We do.
Do they?
Our children do. I mean, our grandchildren.
25 years ago, I read it.
Well, there are some.
There's an interesting thing that happened. Of course, you have to know the area and the children and so on. But this is at a sixth grade level. And in talking about literature and trying to introduce it and working through with it, we mentioned that, well, probably one of the first things that you remember was nursery rhymes. You said, like, Little Boy Blue Song. And then to find out how many children in the class, in a sixth grade class now, knew some of the most common ones, like Little Boy Blue. I think that's a very common
one. Mm-hmm.
And do you know that they got interested, and at sixth grade level, they wanted to read, and we did.
Mm-hmm.
We took time out and read these.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then that led into what are some other forms of literature, and we went from that, of course, to the myths, and then eventually to the fables, and the purpose of them, and why they had them. And those children went back and did what you might have expected to have happened to them earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But this class had a tremendous literature experience that
mm-hmm.
just came about accidentally, of course.
No, but that's really exciting.
And they felt they had missed all of it.
Mm-hmm. Sure, and they had.
So I think if they don't enjoy it one time,
mm-hmm.
maybe it's not too late yet.
No, that's right. And I think some of the Mother Goose books are really they're really fun now. They've been coming out more, and we've been reprinting them, and the illustrations are great, and you don't have to worry. The texts are the same; they're not going to be varied that much. So you know, they're worth investing in, I think, really. Fairy tales are something that I was glad what you said earlier. Some of you didn't hear. Well, both of you mentioned the fact that for some people, some of us when we were small, if you in certain, particularly in certain areas, if you talked about some imagined thing or fantasy, you were really suspect. And well, that's a lie. That's not true. You mustn't tell untruths. Now you've got to be clear on this. You know what's true and what isn't true. And generally speaking, it's true that sometimes children can keep on in this fantasy thing for a little longer than necessary because they find it very convenient. But on the other hand, it is true that most of us don't have enough of it, and most people today don't have enough of that kind of imaginative life. And I think that's one reason why the Tolkien books, The Lord of the Rings, were so popular on the college campuses. Now Time Magazine, when the C.S. Lewis biography came out, the English biography came out, Time had this long article, and I don't always trust Time Magazine by any means, but they did say that C.S. Lewis's books were becoming more and more popular on the college campuses, that his science fiction, as well as his straight polemics on Christianity. You realize that there's been a hole someplace where there's really been a starvation, and a hunger has developed for something that is in the fantasy world. And my goodness, you know, this is the way most of them look. Mm-hmm. And this wasn't our book. This is just one of the many copies of the three volumes of the Ring books that we've had up here, mm-hmm. and they are worn to shreds. We have to keep on, you know, resupplying them. It took me a long time to read them because everybody in our family read them, and I just was so stubborn I wasn't going to read them because I thought, okay, you can read them and just go ahead, and I'm not going to read them. I don't have to do everything this family does. And they all pressured and pressured until finally when I broke my leg, I read them. But they really are exciting. But you have to have some time to read them because they are long, and some people, it just isn't their cup of tea. They just get turned off by it completely. And you have to be careful not to make value judgments if you happen to like something and then somebody else doesn't, then you sort of begin to suspect them and you wonder, you know, what's the matter with you? But, you know, after all, we don't have the same taste in food either. And we don't all like the same kinds of things, fortunately. It would be a dull world, wouldn't it, if we all did. But I think there's something about the Fellowship of the Ring that meets a need. And, you know, I read it, and you may be shocked. Well, you'll have to be shocked if you want to be. But I read it during Lent. I broke my ankle on Ash Wednesday, and it was broken in a very serious way, so I had to have an operation, and I had to be in the hospital, and then I had to be in a cast for a long, long time. And I read these Ring books, and I was reading my usual Lenten devotional reading along with it. And you know that when I was reading those books, it really pointed up to me in a way that I got so involved in it, I was almost afraid to sleep up there at night in my room because everybody would go out, of course, and leave me up there, and the dog would be downstairs barking, and I never knew, you know, I thought, me, what are we being invaded by? And but you know, I got this feeling of the real battle between good and evil, which is what Tolkien gets across so marvelously. And you realize that is what life is about. There is a real fight, and so often in our protected atmospheres, the kind of protection we make for ourselves, particularly in our Christian lives, sometimes we don't sense the drama of that battle and the fact that Jesus had to go to the cross becomes so often a kind of a psychological thing. Well, you know, that's, you know, and we're really serious about it too. But the great cosmic battle, which is part of the Christian faith, is lacking, not because we haven't read it, not because it isn't in the scriptures, but simply because we haven't gotten it into our imaginations. And when it doesn't become part of you inside, you know, it's just not there. And you mouth it, but you don't feel it. And believe me, that Lent, I really experienced in a whole new way what it was to be struggling against this principalities and powers and spiritual wickedness in high places. I felt the Prince of Darkness and the awfulness of the whole conflict. So that's where I think something like the Tolkien books, which is really too old for children again, little children certainly, when they get into, you know, 12, 13, 14, they start reading and then they read them over again. The books that I'm going to close with are the, I do encourage you to look at fairy tales simply because I think that in general, they are an obvious kind of way to develop the imagination, but don't think that children are all going to like fairy tales, because really the fairy tale, like the myth and legend, a lot of it can be a very adult form of writing. And the fairy tales, you know, don't have to be just for children. And don't think you, just because you feel like, well, you have to be a child to understand the fairy tale, that doesn't mean you have to be a child, but you do have to have what Tolkien calls an appetite for marvels. I guess it's Andrew Lang, and I think that's true. You had an appetite for marvels. You really have to really want exciting things to happen. And this is what fairy tales usually have happening. Even if they're fairly predictable in the way they happen, that, you know, that's the stuff that's in them. The books that I absolutely feel are musts for Christians, at least, to read are the Narnia books. Now, I don't usually put thou shalt read on any book, because I think that people, certainly you have to be able to choose your own, and it's not part of the commandments any more than thou shalt celebrate. But the reason I feel that people generally should expose themselves to the Narnia books is that they do, in a way that I know of no other, I don't know any other books that do this. The vehicle, the book itself is so entertaining that I had an argument with a minister's wife who had read them and thoroughly enjoyed them and absolutely refused to see any kind of other meaning than just what was right on the surface. And that's the way it should be. That's absolutely the way it should be. If you're writing fiction, it shouldn't be to teach a lesson. It's got to entertain. And the wonderful thing is, it's a marvelous bait. And I've not been in favor of baits as a rule, because I think, oh, that's dishonest, you know. And then I think, well, you know, Jesus said that we should be fishers of men. And I don't know anybody that fishes without bait unless you take a net. Of course, you could take a net, maybe you can call it a net. You know, maybe that's what you can call this style of writing, a net to catch the fish. But it does catch people. Now, this is where it catches people. As you said, you know, like with the Mother Goose rhymes, and you go back with something, this catches people with a gripping kind of a story that actually has, you know, has all the whole plan of salvation in terms of the crucifixion and the suffering and the battle with good and evil and the discipleship involved in it. And furthermore, it you sense the Christian life as a venture, a risk. It's not outlined. You've got the map, it's all fixed up, no problems. There are always unexpected things happening. There are certain things that you have to do, for instance, obeying certain things that the great lion has told somebody to do. If she didn't do that, you know, she got into real trouble, and she did in one of the books, one of the little girls. But the whole story is one that I would say, when I mentioned at the beginning, how did you bring us up? I guess I would have to say that the Narnia books brought our children up in terms of grace, in terms of understanding each other, in terms of understanding the world, and eventually realizing what a great Lord they had. Now, to be able to do this without pushing it as a Sunday school lesson is something. How many of you have read the Narnia books? Well, you've got a treat in store for you. You really have got to, you absolutely have to read them. They are bar none. Now, this is one of our copies. I think this is the second round.
How do you spell the
No, this is the first one. Narnia, and it's written. They're written by C.S. Lewis. This is the first book we got. This is in 1952, and this was the very first one. It was the first one that came out that we were able to get in this country. It wasn't the first book in the series, and there are seven of them, and they come now in a little slip cover, in paperback, and well, you don't have to buy them. You know, you can read one of them. Read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which is the first book. Try that on for size. One of the great statements from that book, from the books, is the one that Mr. Beaver says when the the children have gone through the wardrobe into this land of Narnia. Children are staying with the Beaver family. There's a very important event that has taken place, and one of the boys has gotten into trouble, and they're so disturbed because they realize that the only way that that boy can be saved is if somebody is willing to die for him. So who can do it? You know, who's strong enough? And finally, Mr. Beaver says that he hears some crackling up there in the woods, and he thinks it might be Aslan. And the children say, "Who's Aslan?" "Well, he's a great big lion with a huge mane and really frightening." And one of the girls, the other little girl, says, "Well, is he safe?" And Mr. Beaver says, "Of course he's not safe, but he's good. He's not safe, but he's good." And I think that's one of the most profound statements that can be made about Christianity, about Jesus Christ, about God himself, is that we know that he's good, no matter what kind of unpredictability we get into. It's his goodness. It's the gospel. And that's what you get out of all the books. Just, you get flooded with the gospel. It's really, really great. But it doesn't come in verses and chapters. It comes as a story, and that's what's great.